pull up a chair for this one. Because 99 years ago today, a 25-year-old airmail pilot from Minnesota did something so audacious, so absolutely reckless by the standards of his time, that half the people watching him that morning at Roosevelt Field, Long Island, expected him to die. I'm Tail Dragger. And this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today is May 20th, and if this date doesn't ring a bell for you, well, we need to fix that right now. May 20th, 1927. That is the day Charles Augustus Lindbergh pointed a silver Rhine monoplane down a muddy, rain-soaked runway and aimed it at Paris. Now, before we get into the flight itself, you have to understand what he was up against. The Ortaig Prize, $25,000, offered by Raymond Ortaig, a French-born hotel owner in New York, to the first aviator to fly non-stop between New York and Paris, either direction. The prize had been sitting unclaimed since 1919, 8 years. And by the spring of 27, some of the biggest names in aviation had tried or were about to try. René Fonck, the French ace, had crashed on takeoff the previous September in a massive Sikorsky trimotor. Burned right there at Roosevelt Field. Two of his crew died. Commander Richard Byrd had a big Fokker trimotor called the America sitting in a hangar nearby, but his team kept delaying. Clarence Chamberlain had a Balanca with the range to do it, but his backers were tangled up in lawsuits, and two French aviators, Nungesser and Coley, had just vanished over the Atlantic, flying east to west, only 12 days before Lindbergh's attempt. Vanished. No wreckage, no trace, the Atlantic had swallowed them whole, so the smart money said this could not be done safely. Not yet. Not with the engines and instruments of 1927, and certainly not alone. That was what made Lindbergh different from every other competitor. He was going alone. One pilot, one engine. No co-pilot to share the watch. No navigator to work the charts. No radio operator to call for help. Just him, a Wright Whirlwind J5C radial engine turning over at 1700 RPM, and enough fuel to carry him 3,600 miles if the winds cooperated, and that fuel. Let's talk about the fuel. The Spirit of St. Louis carried 450 gallons of gasoline. That airplane weighed about 2,200 pounds empty. Loaded with fuel, oil, water, some sandwiches, and Lindbergh himself, it came in at about 5,100 pounds on that morning, more than double its empty weight. Every engineer in the country was doing the math and shaking their heads. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now here's where it gets interesting. The airplane itself, the Spirit of St. Louis, was not some glamorous thoroughbred. It was a purpose-built fuel tank with wings. Ryan Airlines of San Diego built it in 60 days. 60 days, the chief engineer, Donald Hall, basically designed the thing around one question. How do we carry enough fuel to reach Paris? The answer was to put the main fuel tank in front of the cockpit. Right where the windshield should be? Lindbergh could not see forward. Let that sink in. He had no forward visibility. He had a small periscope he could extend out the left side, and he had side windows. That was it. For takeoff, for landing, for 33 and a half hours of flying, he was looking out the side of the airplane like a dog with its head out a car window. The cockpit was tiny, a wicker seat to save weight. No parachute. He figured if something went wrong over the Atlantic, a parachute was just dead weight, the instrument panel was sparse. An earth inductor compass was his primary navigation tool, a couple of fuel gauges, an altimeter, an airspeed indicator, a tachometer, basic engine instruments. That was the glass cockpit of 1927. The morning of May 20th was not ideal. It had rained. The runway was soft. There was a light tailwind, which is exactly what you do not want for a maximum gross weight takeoff. Lindbergh had barely slept the night before. Some accounts say he had been awake for more than 24 hours before he even climbed into the cockpit. His friends had kept him up. The excitement, the anxiety, the finality of the decision. He would later say the hardest part of the entire flight was deciding to go. At 7:52 in the morning, he opened the throttle. The Wright Whirlwind coughed, caught, and roared. The Spirit of St. Louis began to roll down that muddy strip. Roosevelt Field's runway was not paved. It was dirt and gravel, and it was soft from the rain. The airplane was so heavy she accelerated like she was dragging an anchor. Lindbergh had told his ground crew to watch for a signal. If the airplane was not flying speed by a certain telephone pole, he would cut the engine and abort. Spectators lined the field. Some had come to watch history. Some had come to watch a crash. The Spirit of St. Louis bounced once, twice. The telephone wires at the end of the runway were coming up fast. Lindbergh held her on the ground an extra second, building just a little more speed, then eased back on the stick. She lifted, she cleared the wires by about 20 feet. Some witnesses said less, and just like that, she was climbing out over Long Island, pointing northeast, headed for the Atlantic. Now think about what he was facing. 3,600 statute miles, no GPS, no VOR stations over the ocean, no ATC to call, no weather radar. He had a chart, he had his compass, and he had dead reckoning. He planned to fly a great circle route, which meant a series of course changes plotted on his chart. He would estimate his wind drift by watching the white caps on the ocean and adjusting. If he could see the ocean over the North Atlantic in May, fog banks and cloud layers were a certainty.
The first challenge hit almost immediately. The cold, he was flying at altitudes between sea level and 10,000 feet, depending on the clouds, and the open-sided cockpit let the Atlantic air pour in. He had a leather flying suit, but his feet went numb, his hands ached, and the fatigue. The fatigue was the real enemy. By the second night over the ocean, he had been awake for nearly 50 hours. He hallucinated. He later wrote about phantoms in the cockpit, ghostly figures that appeared beside him and spoke to him. The spirit of St. Louis would drift. He would catch himself with a wing dropping, airspeed decaying, and jerk awake. He flew just above the waves at times, letting the spray hit his face to stay conscious. He opened the side window and held his hand in the slipstream. He stomped his feet. He sang. He did everything a human being can do to fight sleep at 2 in the morning over a black ocean with no horizon. The navigation was remarkable. Flying by dead reckoning across featureless water for hours at a stretch, he hit his waypoints with astonishing accuracy. When he finally made landfall over Ireland, he was almost exactly where he had planned to be. He had been in the air about 28 hours at that point. He crossed Ireland, then the southwestern tip of England, then the English Channel, and then France. The sun was setting as he crossed the French coast. He followed the Seine River toward Paris, and when he arrived at Le Bourget airfield at 10:22 Paris time on the night of May 21st, he had been in the air 33 hours and 30 minutes. He had covered 3,610 miles. He had 185 gallons of fuel remaining, enough for another 1,000 miles. The engine never missed a beat.
But what he could not have anticipated was the crowd. Over 100,000 Parisians had driven out to Le Bourget. They had been listening to reports of his progress on the radio. When they saw the silver monoplane circling the field, they broke through the fences. They swarmed the runway. Lindbergh had to land on a field covered with people who were scrambling to get out of his way and rushing toward him at the same time. He touched down and the crowd engulfed the airplane. They pulled him from the cockpit. They nearly tore the spirit of St. Louis apart for souvenirs. French pilots and soldiers had to rescue him and spirit him away to safety. In 33 hours, Charles Lindbergh went from an unknown airmail pilot to the most famous person on the planet. He did not just win the Ortega Prize. He changed the trajectory of aviation. Before his flight, the public saw airplanes as dangerous toys for daredevils. After Paris, they saw them as the future of transportation. Investment in aviation companies surged. Applications for pilot training flooded flight schools. The number of licensed pilots in America tripled within a year. Airlines that had been struggling to sell tickets suddenly had passengers lining up. And the Wright Whirlwind engine. That J5C radial that ran flawlessly for 33 and a half hours over the North Atlantic became the most famous engine in the world. Wright Aeronautical could not build them fast enough. The reliability of that power plant was the unsung hero of the flight. Lindbergh chose a single engine over the tri-motors, his competitors favored because he calculated that one good engine was more reliable than three mediocre ones, and a single engine gave him the fuel efficiency he needed for the range. He was right.
The Spirit of St. Louis flew on after Paris. Lindbergh took her on a tour of the United States, visiting all 48 states, landing at hundreds of fields, letting Americans see the airplane that had done the impossible. Then she went to the Smithsonian Institution, where she hangs today in the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. If you have never stood beneath her and looked up, you owe yourself that trip. She is smaller than you expect. You stand there and think, he crossed the Atlantic in that? And the answer is yes. Yes, he did.
99 years ago today. Most of what I shared tonight comes from Lindbergh's own account in his book The Spirit of St. Louis, along with A. Scott Berg's biography Lindbergh. Both are worth your time if you want the full story. You can find us at radiohanger.com. Fly safe out there. And next time somebody tells you something cannot be done, remember that muddy runway on Long Island and a 25-year-old kid who could not even see where he was going.